Hey, this is Thurston. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby. Yeah, keep listening.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded October 11th, 2023. Well, there is perhaps no greater symbol of the vagaries of empire than Granada's Alhambra, the fabulous palace, product of the 13th century Nasrid dynasty, last bastion of the Moors on the Iberian Peninsula, and home to Emperor Carlos V before its abandonment in the 18th century during the French occupation of Spain, played host last week to the third summit of the European political community. French President Emmanuel Macron's brainchild is meant to be a, quote, platform for political coordination among European countries across the continent to promote political dialogue and cooperation to strengthen security, stability, and prosperity. Though the third iteration of the EPC was dismissed in the press as a failure on multiple fronts, the summit did provide a further chance for the would-be technocratic emperors of a new Europe to cement plans for the digital transition of the continent, something they made a key goal. Stavroula Pabst is a writer, comedian, and PhD student in communications and mass media studies at the National and Capodistrian University of Athens. Her writing appears online at The Gray Zone, Reductress, The Harvard Business Review, and Unlimited Hangout. Stavroula's work is also featured at Substack, where she's just launched the TechX Geopolitics newsletter, and it's where I found her latest article, EU Digital Identity Wallet Pilots Rollout Under the Radar. Stavroula Pabst in the first half. And as the leaders of Western civilization cheer the obliteration of the captive population of Gaza, no one need be reminded we live in dark and dangerous times. But even the most jaded are ill-prepared for the revelations of the abysmal depth and gaping width of depravity afforded through the aegis of the COVID-19 response. T.J. Coles is director of the Plymouth Institute for Peace Research and the author of numerous books, including The War on You, Manufacturing Terrorism, Capitalism and Coronavirus, How Institutionalized Greed Turned a Crisis into a Catastrophe, and many others. His latest is The Pfizer Papers, The Secret Documents Exposing Big Pharma's COVID Vaccine Crimes, an investigation into what is certainly the greatest crime of this young century and perhaps the greatest in history. T.J. Coles and going through the Pfizer Papers in the second half. But for Stavroula Pabst and the digital architecture of dystopia being built right before your eyes. Well, welcome back to the program, Stavroula.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Stavroula, before getting to your article, EU Digital Identity Wallets Pilots Rollout Under the Radar, what is and why TechX Geopolitics?
Thank you for highlighting. I am launching a new newsletter on my Substack. I'd like to have a newsletter because it's kind of a good way to keep myself disciplined, to be honest. But that's the joke answer. But the serious answer is that I write a lot on geopolitics. And I think my observation over the last year or so is that I see a lot of very good work being done in geopolitics, obviously, but I think a severe limitation I've noticed is I think a lot of people that comment on geopolitics may not comment on the tech aspects as much, which I actually think, you know, limits what we should be talking about, or it limits what is being understood, because the reality of the matter is tech is moving very fast. It's obvious to say that the moving state of tech right now is going to determine the future of geopolitics. I think that this is clear right now if we look at what's going on worldwide, especially with the rollout of digital IDs like we will discuss some today. CBDCs, et cetera, I think it's very critical that we are integrating tech discussions into what we are discussing when we discuss geopolitics as well. So the point for me is kind of based on that observation to be able to do that more and to be able to highlight stories, especially for the independent media, but in general, that are at this intersection so that there is some discussion and fusion of the two topics. And when I say that, I don't mean to say that no one is doing this, but I think that there is definitely more room to focus on this intersection of the two subjects of technology and geopolitics. That's it in short.
Yeah, and we talked about this synthesis in the last time we spoke, and we were talking around your article at that point, Ukraine's Future Lies in the Great Reset, and involving the lead up to the Ukraine war, and or how the Ukraine war accelerated the adoption of this tech app, the DIA, which is a gateway into this nexus world that you describe. Am I getting close to it here?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that we can say crisis definitely facilitates a lot of these tech advancements. Granted, I think that there would be efforts made towards them anyways, but certainly a crisis like war makes it perfect. And I think with the DIA app, it's something where I know the DIA app in particular has been used to give people wartime stipends if they've been affected by the conflict, for example. So even let's say you have security concerns about the DIA app, or maybe you're creeped out about it or just don't really want to use it. You know, maybe you have those concerns, but now that you're in a time of crisis, it's easier for the powers that be, in this case, the Ukrainian government and the Ministry of Digital Transformation, it's easy for them to say, look, you know, this is why this technology is helpful. We're in a crisis. We're going to get through this together. And then I think what then gets left out are the ethical implications, which are huge. They need to be discussed. I'm very concerned about them personally. And I think with something like DIA, for example, but any technologies rolling out, it's something where it's like once it's more or less expected that you would use something like DIA or a digital ID, et cetera, something like this. I think once you adopt it and it becomes a standard in everyday life, or at least common in everyday life, even if there are mainstream ethical concerns and a lot of people are upset about it, I think once these things are established, it's very hard to roll them back. I think that that's a major concern. You know, even if people have their worries, it becomes very difficult to fight something that's already been established, is how I see it.
Yeah, and you make that point in your article. And again, it's EU digital identity wallet pilots roll out under the radar. I got the image reading that of one of those zap straps, you know, that you can tighten it, but you can never loosen it off.
Yeah, that's exactly how I see it. And I think that that's something I'm particularly worried about with something like a digital ID, because I can understand why many people would consider something like digital ID to be a normal thing, you know, maybe, or maybe they don't love it, but maybe they would be like, oh, you know, there are certain ways that a digital ID would be convenient for me. Like if it makes it easier to prove my identity when I need to, I'm going to take it on. So maybe they accept on these initial additional concept of what the digital ID is, not understanding that the potential for scope creep is huge. I think that that is a critical point to be said with the digital ID or anything like it, something like any type of state app, any type of apps where services are provided by the state. It is very easy to add or manipulate services, right, with just simple app programming.
Well, there's going to be early adopters for any technology. And I've seen ads where this idea of putting chips in your arm, and instead of even having a wallet, you can just have an implant put in. And then they feature these influencer types waving their hands over readers and saying, look at how easy it is. And now I never have to carry a wallet again. Like carrying a wallet, it was a really onerous thing to have to do. But the convenience is always accentuated, but never any of these other questions that the underlying dark side of this technology, it's never even hinted at.
I'm not convinced a lot of the people pushing something like digital ID, I'm not convinced that they want serious public debate about something like it, right? I think that they would like to be able to establish these things without these types of conversations, or they would like a situation where they can present their side of the story and hope that we accept it. And I know with like the, I can talk a little bit about some of the messaging used regarding the EU digital identity wallets, for example, if you'd like. I mean, I've looked quite a lot about what they say about it. They tend to say that, look, this is a more secure way to present your info safely, as opposed to, let's say you're online, you don't really understand what third-party providers may be doing with your data. In all fairness, they have a point. I don't know what's being done with my data online, but they're acting like the digital identity wallet is there for a solution to that, when in fact agreeing to digital identity wallet means, well, instead of these random third-party providers having your info, you're essentially giving that info to the state, right? So this is a situation where they're saying, oh, it's secure. But that's a little bit more of a complicated, that's a more complicated talking point than they are letting on. And I think that their messaging in general signals that. They talk a lot about, if we look at the pilot projects for the EU digital wallets, there's a wide range of use cases which suggest, you know, for example, you can use, they're saying, for example, in the pilots, they're testing out using the wallets to be able to apply for bank accounts, bank loans, activate SIM cards, in some cases being able to use it to show digital prescriptions across borders, a number of even checking out into hotels, for example. So they're essentially telling you, you can use this digital identity card, or not card, e-wallet, sorry, every day in your life. So they're essentially showing you, this is something we want you to use almost every day. They're not talking about then the ramifications of you using this digital wallet and how that could be monitored. We don't know. We have to speculate a little bit. But essentially, a digital wallet is something that if the state wants to, it can learn a lot about your everyday life if it simply knows about when you're using it, right? So I think they're presenting a lot of these positives without discussing, hey, this is actually a complicated discussion that should theoretically be had by the general public. I don't think that they really want a discussion about this with the general public. And I mean, part of the reason I wrote this story is because some of this stuff had happened earlier this summer, but I didn't even see anything about it until like September. And I was just thinking to myself, you know, this is significant progress towards a digital ID in Europe, which has significant ramifications as to whether digital IDs will be mainstreamed like in public life, right? Like all around the world. I couldn't believe that I didn't know about it, considering I do spend a lot of time reading news. I do keep up to date with things. And so I think that they kind of know, for a number of reasons, especially due to the fact that, you know, there's a couple different wars now going on. I think it's an easy time for them to be able to say, we're going to do this without a lot of public debate. So yeah, in short, I just think that they want to be able to pass these things. They want to make this a norm for society. This norm would then change a lot of things about our daily lives, but they don't really want to seem to talk about it.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Stavroula Papps. Stavroula is a writer, comedian, a PhD student in communications and mass media studies at the National and Kapodistrian University of Athens. Her writing appears online at The Gray Zone, Reductress, The Harvard Business Review, and Unlimited Hangout. And Stavroula's work is also featured at Substack, what we're talking about, her recent launch of her new newsletter, And her other writings can be found there, well, at the newsletter TechX Geopolitics Newsletter. When you say that you're turning over your information to the state, in the case of Europe, you're turning your information over to this super state, this EU that's even another stage removed from control, even more so than a national state would be for, say, someone like me in Canada.
In my opinion, one of the general themes of today's geopolitics, let's say it that way, is about the loss of sovereignty. And I think that something like, you know, when I see European leaders meet and discuss these major policy initiatives, I know that effectively, as a citizen of Europe, I am actually an EU citizen, I know that I effectively, if I have a problem with what they are discussing, I really have no recourse over that, right? And I think in turn, you know, this is a complicated discussion, and I'm not saying that states have zero influence over, like, the European Commission, for example, but to act like Greece has any real power in the European Union, or really most nation states within the European Union, some more than others do have a say, but the overall trend is that citizens' voices get completely lost. And I think that this is a situation where it's easy to pass sweeping initiatives that have major ramifications for daily life with very little discussion. You know, I would have to look at this, the specific things outlined in this Digital Europe policy package that you brought up. I would have to look into it. I'm sure it's consequential, and I'm sure there's actually a lot worth reporting in it, you know, because this isn't really even being publicized. You know, no one's really covering these topics. We don't hear about them. No one really, effectively, people don't even know how they can provide input or participate if they have an issue with things. I think the picture is a little bit more complicated than what I said, but the loss of sovereignty is just horrid. And I think that it's not just here in Europe that that's the case. I think that this is increasingly the case worldwide. Like, obviously, I'm also an American citizen. I'm not saying that my vote has never mattered, but to act like I have ever had really any, you know, my ability to influence American politics by honestly participating is quite limited, right?
Well, even by dishonestly participating, it's hard to make a change there.
Well, I guess that's true. But, you know, so I think that this loss of sovereignty is happening in places like Europe. And I think Europe, it's especially bad because, to be honest, in my opinion, Europe is subservient to the United States. So separate of that, though, I think that this is a general trend that needs to be discussed. I think that this is happening internationally. And I think what's happening effectively is there is a shift from traditional policymaking structures. And they had problems. I'm not trying to act like they were perfect or that we had a really real say over our affairs in that way. But what's happening is whatever democratic structures were built into those are now being lost and sapped out as these other superstructures take over. And things like public-private partnerships are being normalized. I mean, it's something where civilians have less and less ability to hold somebody to account. And I actually think, to bring that back a little bit to the EU digital identity wallets pilot programs, I think over 20 European countries are involved, but also 250 corporations are involved in these pilot projects. Okay, theoretically, I'm not acting like I really have control over the EU, but theoretically, as an EU citizen, I theoretically can vote so-and-so out of office. I have no say over what these corporations that are participating in the pilot program are doing, right? So what we're seeing is this normalization of structures where what was once government responsibility is now being handed over to entities that are even more unaccountable, right? And it's kind of being done with the bat of an eye. If you look at legislation or policy proposals being put forth, this is something that the elite class, let's say, is trying to make completely normal. And it's something where I almost feel like I have, they don't want you to reply to that or say, that's actually kind of weird. You can't just collaborate with JP Morgan whenever you want. you know.
Yeah, well, the elite class is a dead giveaway. These meetings, these Emmanuel Macron's summits have been held in castles so far, and the Alhambra being the latest in Spain. And so I went to the Spanish page. It actually wasn't all that easy to find information on these meetings. But what they announced there is their so-called path to the digital decade by 2030. So we're
getting, okay, I know what that is.
We're getting fairly far along. Pedro Sanchez, the Spanish president, he said, and I'll quote him, he says, "We need a proper regulatory framework which encourages technological development and protects our rights and our values. In short, we must have a humanist outlook on digital transformation, giving security and confidence to our fellow citizens." It's pretty anodyne, boilerplate kind of statement. But they realize that these are the kinds of worries that people like you and others have about what's going to happen. In 2021, he mentions that Spain approved something they called the Digital Rights Charter. Do you know what that is? Or I mean, I'm sure from the title, it's easy to surmise. But I mean, is that enough?
I don't know enough about that specifically to be able to comment, unfortunately. I would say that I'm happy that people are trying to pass those things. But, you know, I think what's actually pretty important is, you know, you noted that the word transformation is being proposed, digital transformation. You know, they are actively using what I would consider to be extreme language at all points. You can't propose the digital transformation of society without asking the general public about or putting it to some kind of, you know, the general public is not being asked about whether they want a digital transformation of society, right? So I hope that some of these charters, I hope to look into this charter, actually. I hope that these types of efforts do act as safeguards in ways, but no, I'm not convinced that would be enough just by hearing it. Obviously, I would have to read more into what that is specifically.
The worries that you elucidate, they don't have to all be theoretical. We've seen these kinds of technologies adopted, and as you mentioned in your article, in India, the Aadhaar, or their biometric ID system, was already run. Do you want to tell us a little bit about India's experience?
My understanding is that the result of that is that many people who access rations from the state that are subsidized rations for a lot of complicated reasons. Maybe people are shut out. Maybe people can't log in to access their credentials needed. A lot of people, unfortunately, fall through the cracks, especially in rural areas. So I think here with something like the Aadhaar system, we see an unintended, I mean, who knows if we can really discuss intention, but we see an unintended consequence of the system where you're trying to digitize society and now you're leaving behind the most marginalized people, right? And my understanding is that dozens of people died because they couldn't access their food rations or their subsidized food rations because of these technical difficulties. Despite that, which I consider to be an obvious issue with the Aadhaar program, India has more or less hailed it as a success. So, and I think that most of the reporting on the Aadhaar system is not critical of it. And so, you know, it leads to the further normalizations of these systems that can leave people out in really deadly and dangerous ways. And I'd have to assume that the EU digital identity wallet would do something similar. I mean, I live in Greece and, you know, there are many migrants here that have fallen through the cracks of the immigration system here, right? This is a very complicated topic, but I've seen the Greek state move their feet or, you know, slow their feet on a lot of legal processes, which means some people don't have documents for years because of the state, you know. So I live somewhere where it's very obvious to me that if you implemented digital IDs, a lot of these people are already shut out of work and you know, society generally, that would push them much even further into poverty. You know, this would lock people out of society in ways that we haven't seen. And I think a precursor of some of this, you know, was the vaccination passport scheme used in much of Europe. In Greece, you had a QR code vaccination passport, but you also had to show your ID to show that you could prove who you were. So it shut out a lot of people who did not have identity cards. So if you move on to something like the EU digital identity wallet, who knows how it will be used, but the point is we're facilitating a situation where a lot of people, and especially the most marginalized, you know, poor people, migrants, elderly people, et cetera, they will be the most affected by this. And I do think that it has potentially dangerous and deadly ramifications, as we have seen in India.
Well, and in your article, too, and we're fast running out of time, Stavrila, but you quote Eve Hayes DeCalif, and she talks about states being able to weaponize these systems, these international systems. The Indian, in India, the Aadhaar biometric ID was married to their unified payment interface, their UPI. So you see the same idea here with the UDI and the European digital framework and the digital euro that's coming, where all of these things are rolled together in what you describe as a scope creep, where what is used in the case of the DIA starts out simple and is accepted, and this is a matter of convenience, until before you know it, you can't make a move anywhere without being approved by the state. And this brings in, of course, the specter of a social credit system.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to say what forms this could take on in the future. And I think that that's the point of reporting on it now. I don't know what the end result of a digital identity wallet in Europe will be. I don't know what something like DIA could finally turn into, but it is important for us to speculate about these worst case scenarios, because we have seen some pretty bad situations already in the last few years. I mean, like we have said, the vaccination passport program functionally banned people from society. So we've already seen these types of initiatives weaponized to destroy people's lives, essentially. So maybe it's hard for me to say exactly what will happen with the digital identity wallet in Europe. I think we can say that DIA could look like something like a precursor. I can't say that for sure, but what I can say, and as I did say in the article, Ukraine is literally assisting with the EUDI wallet pilots. My understanding is that they had a consortium, and that experts from the DIA app had actually kind of showed off the DIA app to people working on the European Union digital identity pro pilots. So I know that there is collaboration ongoing. We also know that DIA is spreading around the world. I've reported on this as well. I mean, USAID, which is functionally a CIA front, USAID is helping DIA spread worldwide, or it's helping equivalents pop up worldwide, as I should say. A number of countries are exploring equivalent programs, like Estonia's MRIC. So this is something that is becoming normal, and we're seeing essentially something, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if most countries had something like DIA in 5 years. And if we look at something like DIA, we know that they are trying to make it a hub for daily life, right? They want you to be on that app as much as possible for whatever it is. So it's very hard to foresee exactly what will happen, but I'd have to say I don't see it going anywhere good. I think that that's what we can say.
Well, you can find Stavrila Papp's article, EU Digital Identity Wallet Pilot Rolls Out Under the Radar, at thebrownstone.org, the Brownstone Institute, or at her Substack site. And you can also go to Substack to find Stavrila's new newsletter, TechX Geopolitics. You can sign up and get that in your mailbox weekly, I think is the initial plan, right, Stavrila?
Probably every other week, but we'll see. Maybe every week soon.
Well, thanks a lot, Stavrila, for coming on and talking to us a little bit about it today, eh?
Yeah, Yep, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure, and I want everyone to stick around because TJ Coles is coming straight up after the break, and we'll talk a little bit about COVID, the COVID rollout, and his article on the Pfizer papers.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people. Bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999. We're running out.